The 1925 Ben-Hur was intended to establish the reputation of the new studio Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And it did that. And it made a ton of money, and it really made their reputation, put them on the map. And here comes the lion. Remember that 3 years, 2 years after the silent Ben-Hur, there was a silent Life of Jesus, wasn't there? The King of Kings, Cecil B. DeMille's. Keep that in mind. Alrighty? Now, by the mid-1950s, all of the studios in Hollywood were in big financial trouble because of competition from the little tube and because the Supreme Court had ruled it was unconstitutional for them to own all the theaters they showed their films in. And they finally ended that monopoly. And all of a sudden, they were on their own. And MGM in particular was in big financial trouble. So guess what they turned to save their skin? Ben-Hur. Let's redo the most successful movie that we made up to The Wizard of Oz. The one who made us. Let's redo that. And besides, Ben-Hur really fits in the 1950s, doesn't it? Says they. Right? So they dusted it off and decided to make it the biggest thing ever made. And they did. It cost a staggering, unheard of, $15 million. It was nominated for 12 Academy Awards and won every one of them except stage screenplay. Its 11 Academy Awards stood as a record until Titanic tied it in 1990, wherever it was. It won Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Music, Best blah, 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 Best Director, on and on and on. And it was a big event. It was marketed. It was one of the first movies, really, that was marketed. They folded in the emerging market economy. They sent to all of the theaters this huge press book that showed them how to market everything, how to choose your posters and everything, how to sell Ben-Hur to Catholics and on and on. Come and look up this. It's huge. Used to get this little bitty program. Now this huge press book. This is big business. And it made hundreds of millions of dollars. Which MGM turned around and almost lost all of in 1963 with one of the most ill-fated movies ever made, Marlon Brando in Mutiny on the Bounty. So it was all for naught. Now, by now I can assume that students who have had me for a semester know the drill for Ben-Hur, right? So here we go. First of all, you're going to see the logo. Guess what the lion does in this movie? For the only time ever. That's right. He doesn't do anything. He just sits there and looks. This is serious. Leo the lion doesn't roar. We're in church. Folks, that was such a dramatic, you laugh, and it is funny, but it was such a dramatic statement. People have been watching Leo the lion roar for 40 years. But for Ben-Hur, it was a pussycat. And it kept quiet because this is something different. All righty. So I'm going to show you the lion not roaring. The only time it ever happens. We then have a very simple nativity scene. There is almost no emphasis in this movie, even in the nativity, on Mary. Remember how important Mary was in the 25 movie? It is sanctified and all of that kind of stuff. There is nothing Catholic. There is no tableau vivant in the nativity scene. It's just a nice, rustic picture of a man and a woman in a stable with cows and sheep and with some men worshiping them. There's nothing unusual. It's very Protestant. The aesthetic here is very Protestant. In fact, the mother who stars in this nativity scene is a cow. Actually, I'm serious. Watch the mama cow. This is completely unrehearsed because no one could have ever made it happen. William Wyler, the director, the Jewish director, said, "I can't believe that happened. We're going to keep it in." In the forefront of the nativity, Mama Mary and Daddy and Joseph and Jesus are in the background. And in the forefront is this black and white cow. A cow, a lady cow. All right? Her real calf, apparently, is back there behind the nativity scene, behind Jesus and everything. And as the wise men come in and kneel down before Mary and Joseph, in the forefront, the cow starts calling her calf. No, what? You can't make a cow moo. And they didn't try. And here in the middle of it, this little calf jumps over one of the wise men almost and comes and nuzzles his mother. Oh, no one could have planned it. But can you think of a way to more dramatically mark the humanity of Jesus than that? The little calf literally goes and licks his mother's nose, as calves do. All righty? So there you go. The next scene, it's all going very quickly. The next scene, by the way, this is about 15 minutes. Can anyone tell me how long this Ben-Hur lasted? 3.5 hours. Oh, it's wonderful. Folks, if you have never seen the long Ben-Hur, it's just wonderful. It is just wonderful. Next scene is not with Mary, but with Joseph. Because in this movie, it's Joseph who kind of knows who Jesus is, not Mary. Joseph Carpenter, the Roman army is marching through at this scene, going to Jerusalem. We've already seen Messala, getting my M's messed up. Messala, the guy who he defeats in the chariot race. They're passing through Nazareth on the way to Jerusalem. And one of Joseph's neighbor comes into his shop and asks him where his table is. And then he looks around, it's not ready. And that's because Jesus isn't working. He says, "Your son neglects his tasks." And notice what his father says. It's Joseph here, poor forgotten Joseph, who knows who Jesus is. And here we see Jesus for the first time, the back of Jesus with flowing hair. And we will hear the Jesus theme. Then we're at Nazareth again. Masala and Ben-Hur have already clashed in Jerusalem. And Judah has been sentenced to the galleys. And he's on his way to the galleys. And he stops at Nazareth. And here we see Jesus and Judah meet again. Again, we don't see Jesus, but we see his effect on others. We see his effect on others. And here, for the first time, we see his effect on the Roman centurion, who is a real brute. But notice what seeing the face of Jesus does to him. And then I'm going to throw in just a bit of the chariot race, the spectacular chariot race, the most famous action sequence ever filmed. No computers. This is all done. It is astounding. And at one point, the stuntman who is driving Charlton Heston's chariot, although Charlton Heston drove most of it, but they were going to try to get them to jump over a crash. And they do. It's astounding. And the stuntman saves himself. Now, it's not Charlton Heston, but they patch it in later to make it look like it is. Anyhow, you'll see Masala get defeated. The next, we're going to see the Sermon on the Mount. Judah has already hardened his heart, but Esther, the Jewess, his love interest, goes to hear Jesus preach the Sermon on the Mount. And there she looks into Jesus' eyes. This is a silent Sermon on the Mount, the only one. It's wonderful. And she becomes a convert. And she becomes the evangelist. Now, not for being forgiven of your sins through Jesus. Nothing is said in this movie about sin at all. It's she becomes an evangelist for peace of mind. Just like in Norman Vincent Peale. Stealing all of your anxieties. She tries to persuade Judah that Jesus can still quieten all the hatred and turmoil inside of him. It is Esther in this movie who discovers the lepers and tries to persuade Judah to help her take them to Jesus. And they do. But it's not to be cured of her physical ailments. It's not to get your leprosy cleansed. It is to take away the terror in their heart about dying. To get rid of their fears and anxieties about dying. And all of Judah's party, Judah, Esther, his mother, and his sister, are on the road to Calvary, the Via Dolorosa, as Jesus passes. When Jesus, in all of his agony, passes, the lepers forget themselves and their problems. They immediately, in their hearts, reach out to Jesus and have sympathy for him. And they don't call out, "Lord, have mercy on us. We know you can cure us." They say, "Won't someone help him? Help him." And the veil slips off of one of them, like the girl, actually. And nothing happened. Esther says, after he's gone, "I wish that I could. I failed." The mother says, "You haven't failed. The terror, the fear is gone. Their spirits have been healed." Judah here recognizes Jesus and tries to give him water. And he looks into those eyes again. Notice the hands. Hands are important here. They are always reaching out to touch each other's hands. He then follows, the lepers then go back to the cave where they are staying. Judah then follows Jesus to the cross. And we see Charlton Heston at the foot of the cross. He's just seen Jesus die and ask God to forgive him. And Judah, as his heart is changed, Charlton Heston sort of walks a little bit out of the shadow of the cross. And as that shadow passes over his face, he becomes the first convert to Christianity. Dramatic convert, anyhow. Okay? He's now seen Jesus die for his sins. Then we see the miraculous cure. Esther and the two women are in a cave. Jesus is dying. The mother says he is dead. His work is over. But the young lady says, or his sister says, "But I don't feel afraid anymore." Remember Marcellus in the robe? After that overacting, when the robe falls on him, he puts it on his, he says, "I'm not afraid anymore." 6 years later, Tirza in Ben-Hur says, "I'm not afraid anymore. Peace of mind." And in dramatic, some of you are film people. How many of you are film majors, film people doing something? This is some of the best cutting ever. There are flashes of lightning in the rainstorm. You see Jesus's white body dying, dead. Then you see the women, a flash. And you see the miracle happen. You see his hand with a nail through it. You see then their hands now cured. And then they walk out into the purifying rain. Cured. And it ends with this tumultuous hymn of praise as the water and the blood flow mingled down at the foot of the cross and become a cleansing torrent. Folks, which is more powerful? Showing Jesus' face or showing the impact of other people seeing Jesus? No, next time.
We won't move.
Next time you'll get to figure that out as you see Jesus' face for the first time. All righty, any other questions? Seriously. Comments? Yes. Oh, Lord, yes. Everyone saw this movie. This is one of the most popular movies ever made. For years, it was shown at Easter and Christmas on television and everything. Absolutely. Folks, come on. It's the perfect combination of action and Jesus. It's perfect. It's why it's been so great all the time. Read the novel. Actually, don't. But take my course and read the novel. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. All righty, we want to go back now to the impact of social revolutions of the 1960s and the role that Jesus plays in them and those kinds of things. And we got to gender. The demands for racial equality were accompanied by the rise in the 1960s of the women's rights movement. Women as well as black men had served in the armed forces in World War II. And women had entered the workplace in the 1940s, taking up places that men had vacated. Part of the reason for the emphasis on domesticity and gender roles, specific gender roles, and the emphasis on mom being in the house is to force women back into the domestic sphere. We needed them in the 1940s in the workplace. Now go back and bake your biscuits. Now, obviously, this didn't work out. The 60s are just behind, around the corner. There were unending demands in the late 50s and early 60s for sexual equality. They were accompanied by demands of women for access to work and equal pay, for more liberal divorce laws, for more freedom to express themselves sexually in relationships, and most controversially, for control over their own reproductive roles, abortion. And in the 1970s, one of the most notorious and important Supreme Court cases in history, Roe versus Wade, came down with all of its revolutionary reverberations with which we still live. Now, it is my impression that the crusade for women's rights did not spend much time dealing with or fussing about the Pauline scriptures that had been used as the biblical defense for the subordination of women. They just ignored Paul. And instead, they laid claim to the promise of the Great Declaration, and to demand, as women had for more than a century, that those promises now really be extended. Not just the vote, not just citizenship, but real equality be extended to the other half of the human race. Thank you very much. Now, had they wanted to marshal Jesus in their defense in the 60s, as they later do, by the way, they had all kinds of ammunition. They could, of course, point to the privileged role of women in the ministry of Jesus. We've already talked about the unprecedented way in which Jesus reached out of his own historical world to valorize women. But in the 1950s and 60s, women instead emphasized not the literal text of the New Testament, but the final inclusivity of the gospel of Jesus, just as black folk had. So they don't really even mess with religion. women don't. That's for later. Neither did gay and lesbian Americans. The war had also played a role in the emergence of demands for equality for gay and lesbians in the United States. Students of the history of queer America now know that the discharge of hundreds of thousands of men and women at the end of the services was really the beginning of the emergence of a self-conscious America. Virtually every one of those ships landed in a few major ports, such as, you're coming from the Orient, where are you going to land? Come on, play with me. Los Angeles, San Francisco. If you're coming from Europe, folks, where are you going to land? You're going to land in New York City. And lots of those guys and gals didn't go back to Des Moines. Do you know that? It's actually a very important chapter in the history of a self. The war enlisted hundreds of thousands, millions of people and got them together. And then it discharged them at the same time. This never happened before. And it created populations of gay and lesbian people who in the 50s and 60s became increasingly self-conscious in those urban ghettos. In these metropolitan areas in the 50s, there emerged then the first self-consciously homosexual community in the nation's history. They were tolerated with varying degrees of civility, but they were all subjected to periodic assertions of civic control, which led in the summer of 1969 to the turning point in the history of queer America. The Christopher Street riots, the Stonewall riot, summer 1969. Greenwich Village on Christopher Street, right in the middle of that ghetto, a fairly disreputable gang of drag queens would hang out, make fun of everybody, at the Stonewall Inn, a really dump of a bar, which periodically was raided, and the cops would mess up the girls. They fought back in the summer of 1969, one afternoon, and they caused a riot. The queer ghetto erupted in violence because the queens fought back. And they were on the front page of the newspaper for about three very important days. A little old lady who somehow still lived around Christopher Street, can imagine what she thought, looked at all the rioting drag queens and she said, "Oh no, not the fairies too." What do you mean? Well, first the uppity black folk want their rights, and then the uppity women want their rights, and now the fairies too. Oh no, not the, yeah, right, yeah, the fairies too. Now, in the 60s and 70s, the early crusade for gay rights didn't bother with religion at all. Folks, it was just too damned painful. Most of these men and women had been hurt, and sometimes hurt dramatically, sometimes physically, by organized religion. And most of them simply rejected it entirely. And in the 60s and 70s, very few of these early crusaders for gay rights even tried to engage the scriptures on these very controversial issues. And they didn't even try at this point to point out that in the terms of his own society, the strangest thing about Jesus was that he never married and that he hung out with 12 male companions, one of whom was called the beloved apostle. They could also point to Jesus' sustained and sometimes quite bitter attack on the family. If you want to follow me, forget you have a mom and daddy. All of this is in the future. No one even tried to make the case for a queer Jesus in the 60s. That will wait for the 90s. A final word about immigration. The last revolution on our list went largely unnoticed at the time. But it may turn out to be the most important thing that happened in the second half of the 20th century. Write it down. In 1965, the Congress changed the immigration laws and ended all that barrier stuff. And here they came. First by the thousands, then by the hundreds of thousands, then by the millions. And they came from everywhere. They weren't all from England and Ireland. Now, how many, is anyone in this class directly a product of that change in the 60s? Anybody? Oh, yeah, I know some of you are. I know some of you are. All right. And in the next 30 years, the results of that change in the immigration rules work what will probably turn out to be the most important demographic revolution in the history of the 20th century in our country. As Protestant America is simply overtaken by millions of people who have no connection whatsoever to the religions of the book, either the Torah or the Bible or even the Quran. They are from Asia. And they bring to the United States in massive numbers for the first time the great Asian world religions. And the United States, particularly Houston, will never be the same.